Our next guest is the daughter of a movie star.
Did you first make your name and fame at the Savoy Plaza Hotel in a sort of a night act, a singing act?
Yes.
And with the talk of the town. And just as beautiful as Mr. Bennett, sir, thought you were, are you Lena Horne?
Yes. Lena Horne is great.
But when Galamet Buckley traced her genealogy, she found her mother wasn't the only interesting person on her family tree. She writes about how six generations rose from slavery in Atlanta to prosperity throughout the country. Gail's book is called The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family. I spoke with Galamet Buckley in February, and I started with the question I had about why there's no mention of her Southern ancestors in her previous book.
Well, the whole southern part of my family was ignored, basically, in the first book. And I discovered the story of the southern part of the family who lived in Atlanta after my mother died when I found a whole box full of stuff that our distant cousin in Atlanta had been collecting and sending, wonderful documents and newspaper articles and letters. And I thought, this is fascinating. I don't know this story. And I think it's a very good contrast to the northern story, because it was an extended family which separated at the turn of the century. One half stayed in Atlanta and the other half moved north, basically to New York.
So one of the things you said was that you, when you started the research, you expected to find they'd lived a very hard life and struggled and lived in poverty. That's not what you found.
They were very successful people in Atlanta. They were lucky to live in Atlanta because it was a business culture rather than an agricultural culture, planting culture. And black business acumen was celebrated, or at least not denied. And this family was very successful. One of the members was the first licensed black real estate dealer in Atlanta. The other was the longest practicing black doctor in Georgia and the longest practicing black doctor of any race in Atlanta. So these were people who were successful. They went to college. They went to war. They married their childhood sweethearts. They had wonderful family lives, much better family lives, in fact, than the northern half of the family, in which there was divorce and adultery and that sort of thing.
And all kinds of scandal as well.
All kinds of scandal, exactly, which didn't seem to happen in the South.
Well, let's go back to, I guess we could call him the patriarch of the southern family, a Moses Calhoun.
Yes, Moses Calhoun. My great-great-grandfather.
So he seems to have lucked out in at least one way. And I say that in a limited way because he was a slave, originally a house slave. But his owner taught him how to read. Why?
Well, my great-great-grandfather was a butler. His mother was the cook and his sister was the nursemaid. And their owner, Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun, a physician who was the first person to sign the Georgia Article of Secession, very proud of that, wanted a literate butler. It was illegal for slaves or any black people to learn to read and write in the South. But if you were as important a man as Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun, you could do whatever you want. And so my great-great-grandfather was educated, which gave him a head up when freedom came.
And when freedom came, he started his own business. He became quite a successful businessman in Atlanta. What did he do?
Well, he had been a butler, so he knew that he could do well in catering. He had a restaurant. He had a catering service. He had a small hotel. All of this because of Reconstruction and also with help from his former owner. So by 1886, 20 years after the war, the Atlanta Constitution called him the wealthiest colored man in Atlanta. So he had a very good, he was very successful.
This is not the typical American narrative of a slave, right?
No, it isn't. And it's also the narrative of a very small percentage, very lucky small percentage. All of my family were educated, most of them, of the Southern cousins, at Atlanta University. And I think my great-great-grandmother was in the third or fourth graduating class. And they were very lucky, and that was a marvelous place. The head of the university was an extraordinary man.
And
Of Atlanta University, yes. And they were very, very fortunate that they had a head up because Reconstruction only lasted 10 years. But they were able, your family and mine, to take advantage of those 10 years and build a base for future family success.
And yet one of the things that you write about is how this kind of history is missing from our timeline, from the time then that most of us learn. Even though it refers to only a tiny, tiny minority of people, what has been lost in our history when we lose stories like yours?
Well, I think we lose fact that actually the American dream was not entirely closed off to all African Americans. It was, if you had, you had to be educated. That's the thing. You had to be educated. You had to have some sort of sense of economic possibility. Otherwise, you wouldn't make it. And that's the story of any minority, of any person, actually. Most people need an education and a little bit of economic upward mobility to get ahead. And our black relatives were very, very lucky because it didn't happen for most of them.
Moses Calhoun sort of laid an incredibly strong foundation for his family that really set them on the right path for generations to come. What did he do?
Well, he insisted that his daughters, Lena and Cora Calhoun, be educated. Cora went to Atlanta University. His younger daughter, Lena, for whom my mother was named, went to Fisk, where W.E.B. Du Bois, who was there prepping for Harvard, fell madly in love with her and wanted to marry her, but she wouldn't marry him. He was known as Young Willie.
She wouldn't marry him because he was beneath her?
No. He was her age. Maybe he was 17, she was 16. He wanted to marry, he was in love with her, but she chose an older fellow, an older Fisk graduate who was going to be a successful ophthalmologist. And the principal of the first black high school in Memphis, or maybe it was Nashville, I got them mixed up. Anyway, he made sure that his children were educated, and he was very lucky that Atlanta had the Atlanta University and the Storr School. They were known as missionary schools, and they were founded by Northern philanthropists and staffed mostly by white Northern young people, or teachers and students. And they got extraordinary educations. Really excellent educations at all of those early colleges, Atlanta, Fisk, Howard, all of them.
And I don't want to lose people because it's so much easier to follow as you're looking at an actual family tree. But one of the things I love about this book in particular is how closely you interweave great events in black history. And I wonder why you chose to do that rather than just making this a story about what you discovered of your family. Why all the research into what was happening in the broader world?
Well, you can't live in a vacuum, and history is so important in the lives of black Americans. I mean, African-American history is about American history. And you are, I mean, if you're not interested in politics, politics is interested in you if you're an African-American.
At least up for the northern side of your family, I know your great-grandfather co-founded a political lobbying group, the United Colored Democracy. His wife was a suffragette. So your northern side, at least, was involved in politics. What about the southern side?
Not really. Not until the 60s. Not until the Civil Rights Movement. They seemed to stay out of politics, which was wise.
And which was wise? Why do you say that?
Man who was the first licensed real estate, black real estate dealer in Atlanta, had been very high in the Republican Party of Georgia, which was by then a black, basically an all-black party. So he was involved, but they did not. There wasn't much activism going on in that side of the family. But Cora Horn, my great-great-grandmother, who was an activist, had gone to Atlanta University, had had this Southern childhood, Southern young womanhood, and she just took it and went with it.
Yeah, she seems to have been a very strong personality.
Yeah, she was amazing.
So you talk about what happened in the 1960s, and especially down here in the South, as the civil rights movement began to really gain momentum. How did your family interact with that movement, especially here in Atlanta, obviously the hometown of Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, Atlanta University, where all of the members of the family had attended, except for one who went to Fisk, was the scene, really, in 1960. They produced an ad in the Atlanta Constitution saying that they were going to really start the nonviolent civil rights movement, that they, the students of Atlanta University and and the complex there, were going to stand up for their rights as members of the human race and as citizens of the United States of America. And this ad, full-page ad, paid for by Lillian Smith, a white writer from Georgia who wrote Strange Fruit, a novel about lynching, was really the beginning, the announcement of the civil rights movement as a young movement, which it was in the South. It was church people and young people.
You know, and you have written before pretty honestly about how, despite the fact that you were part of a very privileged family, you were part of the bourgeoisie, you encountered racism a number of times. You've also told stories about being you and your brother being the only white kids only black kids at a school in Hollywood where a lot of stars' kids went. Mm-hmm. What did you discover about your Southern cousins and perhaps a completely different interaction with racism and discrimination?
Well, I found out that middle-class black Southern women, especially, did not really interact with white people. They avoided the overt racism. They stayed in their own little world, which was a wonderful world for them, but it was a very tight little world of clubs and community activities, friends, family, and especially church. And that was what they did.
So, I mean, what did you discover? You took away the stories of six generations of your family that you had not, I mean, you spent most of your life not knowing these stories. How does it change your worldview?
Well, it made me... strangely enough, more sympathetic to the South, not to the South per se, but I had a whole other vision of life in the South that was not as happy and as fulfilling as these family members found it. And I just thought they were very brave and they were very dauntless. I mean, they just kept going and they succeeded in spite of everything. And they succeeded by also gaining the respect of the white community as well as the black community. So I thought they were very interesting people.
And, you know, it would seem to have been a lifelong struggle for your mother, the struggle with racism, even over how light-skinned she was. And I wonder if you're surprised that Hollywood still seems to be struggling with those same issues. You've seen the campaign, the hashtag #OscarSoWhite. Are you surprised that it's still going on?
Well, I'm not surprised because Hollywood, the movies were one of the most racist entities in America because they were trying to, in 1915, when the movie sort of came to life with Birth of a Nation, and they were trying to explain America to a nation of immigrants. All of those immigrants arrived in that same time that the movies were coming. So everybody became a stereotype, the black, the Asian, the Mexican, and there was no way for a realistic portrayal because this is what people got used to and wanted. And in the South, it was forbidden to show any black people on the screen except as servants unless it was an all-black movie. And so my mother, the only pictures that she was not cut out of were Cabin in the Sky and Stormy Weather when they were shown in the South because they were all black. Otherwise, she was cut out of every movie she made at MGM. And she was important at the time because it was World War II, and Wendell Willkie and Walter White had gone to Hollywood to try and convince them, the producers, to stop depicting blacks, Asians, and Latins as stereotypes for the sake of the Allies during the war. So my mother was basically a single, she had to be a sort of a superstorm of proving that America, unlike Japan and Germany, was not a racist country. So they needed her to exist, but they didn't want her to be really shown. It's a strange combination.
So any thoughts on how we might solve the dilemma in Hollywood and make it more inclusive than it has been?
Well, just keep fighting and keep struggling and keep trying to make movies that will. I mean, because by now, the South does not cut these people, you know, cut minorities out of movies.
One hopes.
Does not cut black people out of movies. Yeah. So it's the struggle to keep going. I mean, this is what I think I learned from the family, both sides of the family. Keep struggling and keep not letting the struggle destroy you. It's terribly important. And everything conspires against that, of course. So it's very difficult. But it's, you know, we have really, it's this cliche, but it's true. We have come a long, long way if you think about what was going on in 1940 even. There's no doubt.
Gail Lamette Buckley is author of the book The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gail Lamette Buckley is the author of The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family.